welcome to It Just So Happened. I am Richard Paulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 27th of May. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So, where are we? It's two places, but in a single unitary authority. It's been a city since 2001. It was the location of Britain's first casino and Britain's first naturist beach. Yes, of course, it's Brighton! And Hope. We're performing the show in the Brighton Fringe, the largest arts festival in England, and at 31 days, possibly the longest as well. Its roots go back to the 1960s, and our venue this afternoon is the Brighton Toy and Model Museum, housed in a set of four Victorian cellars under Brighton's main train station. It's one of the world's great toy museums. Its displays draw on guest collections and a core collection of over 10,000 items. Staffed mostly by dedicated volunteers, the museum also carries out nationally and internationally important restoration, research and digitisation work, and operates a 9,000-page online encyclopedia and image library used by individuals and organisations worldwide. And we have an audience in the museum with us today. As 8 million people visit Brighton every year, we welcome 1 millionth of that number into the museum. That's actually quite accurate. Talking of all things vintage, let me now introduce today's panel. We have Richie Rounds, Arna Speck, and Mike Coxon. So a chance for you guys just to briefly introduce yourselves. So Richie, I know you're a stand-up comedian and a writer whose jokes and voice have appeared on Radio 4, 4 Extra, BBC Scotland, and you've been on the It Just So Happens shows probably more than any of the guests, because you're much appreciated, including Brighton Fringe last year. Now, I believe you're actually Brighton native, is that right?
That is correct. So I'm actually born in Brighton, which is a relatively rare thing. born but not bred. I'm of mixed heritage. My dad is from London, my mum from Liverpool. And you may notice there is not a lot of Liverpool in my accents from that side of the family. But I discovered a very weird thing. When I had a child of my own, and she grew up down here as second generation in this area, I suddenly realised that I have a lot of northern vowels in my speech from that side of my family. You'll hear them from time to time. And I really started to notice it when I spoke to my daughter, because she'd say words like castle and bath, whereas I would say them correctly.
Right, some nods of agreement. So Arna's also a stand-up comedian. I understand you worked at the Museum of London for 13 years, and now you work at London's Postal Museum.
Yeah, that's right. Hi everyone, my name is Arna. If you think this is a very strange German accent, you're right, because he's from the Netherlands. I worked at the Museum of London for 13 years, from the house, so I know all about a thing that there is a stupid question, and that is where the toilets, where the signs are. But currently I work at the Postal Museum, which is not full of stamps. I'm very happy to know. Actually, you've got a little train. Anyone's been? Awesome. So that's where we're currently. Looking forward to sharing some English history.
And Mike, you are a stand-up comedian as well, who's kindly stepped in at the last minute to replace someone who pulled out 2 days ago, so much appreciated for the show. But that means I don't really have anything I don't know about you. So can you tell us about yourself?
Well, yeah, sure. I'm Mike. I'm a stand-up comedian, regular on the Brighton Comedy Circuit. It's actually my first gig of three today. So it's a rather busy day, so if you want to do a very underwhelming pub crawl, just follow me around town and I'm sure we can have some fun. But I'm very happy to step in. Should be good fun.
Thank you. So let's go straight into some history. And so it's over to you, Richie, for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
Fantastic. I looked at my client, Richard. He wasn't a tall man, but had long hair and a full beard. Kind of like if someone took a Norse god and shrunk it in the dryer. The The case was simple. Find out something that happened on this day in history. Well, it just so happened that on this day in 1894, Dashiell Hammett, the writer, was born. Dashiell Hammett was credited with changing the American detective fiction, changing it from pulp to literature. He wrote 5 books in his life, 3 of them are classed as the top crime amongst the top crime novels of all time, 4 of them the top mystery novels. But where did this investigation start? I sat back in my chair and drank 3 fingers of whiskey. I'd run out of glasses, so I had to drink out of my gloves. In his youth, Hammett was a dick. That is to say, a private detective, not in the Matt Hancock way. Later on, he signed up and fought in World War I. He wasn't there long. He was soon home with 2 things with him. A case of tuberculosis that stayed with him for his whole life, and a wife that didn't. His wife he'd met when she was a nurse, when he was invalided in hospital. When they married, she was already pregnant, which, if nothing else, means she must have been a fantastic nurse. Hammett found himself back home with a new wife, a new baby, and no real way to make money because of his poor health. He spent most of his day doing nothing but just lying. The Sun newspaper hadn't been invented yet. But he became a writer in time, became hugely popular. He started with magazines, then novels, radio, and then movies. Hammett's star was in the ascendant. He made some of the most popular stories of all time, including The Maltese Falcon and Thin Man. He also has one great distinction that other great writers have, and that he's introduced a word into the global lexicon. There is a word you may not have heard of called gunsel. If you look it up, it will be described as a gunslinger or thug. This word, in this usage, was coined by Hammett, because he had Sam Spade describe a character as a gunsel in the original story, the novel, and the movie, The Maltese Falcon. The only problem is that gunsel already had a meaning, and it was not a gunslinger. It's a Yiddish term for a young, kept homosexual man that he was using as an insult. And I like to think that Hammett was laughing all through all of the answers, going, well, that word looks absolutely fine. Eventually, Hammett had to move out of the family home under the advice of his doctor. And let's be honest, if you're being handed that kind of hall pass by your doctor, you can understand why Americans spend so much on healthcare. He became more and more famous as films were made of his books. The Thin Man became a hugely popular series, and money was flying in hand at left, right, and center. There's a story once about him sitting at lunch with a group of producers saying, Dashiell, The Thin Man is so popular and making lots of money, we need another Dashiell Hammett series. We need you to make something else. Something like The Thin Man, but different. So Hammett grabbed a napkin, wrote on that napkin, The Fat Man, and sold it to them for $25,000. They ran that series for 5 years, and that napkin was Dashiell's entire contribution. Eventually, Dashiell started to become a little unpopular. He worked on a comic book series called Secret Agent X-9, and J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, did not like how it represented agencies like his own. He started investigations on him and started to blacklist him. Hammett also had sympathies to communist causes. Not capital C communist, but left-wing, what we call now. Eventually, these investigations started to impede him, but around about this time, Hammett signed up again to fight in World War II, having already fought in World War I. Hammett's popularity in the army was as much as you would expect from a man in his 40s with a lifelong case of tuberculosis and communist leanings, and was quietly given a assignment well away from the front lines. In his later years, Hammett was caught up in McCarthy's witch hunts, the House of Un-American Activities. Because he had communist leanings, he was eventually blacklisted, and for the end of his life, could not find work, his books were taken off the shelves, his name was taken off his TV and radio shows. Imagine having your name taken off the Fat Man when you put all that work into it. It's sad to say that Hammett never really recovered. The money had made his life had long since disappeared. At the end of his life,
He was mostly alone and died penniless. However, this is a noir story, and although they don't have happy endings, they do have some justice. J. Edgar Hoover wanted to block him being buried at Arlington National Cemetery, saying that he was a traitor and a communist. But Hammett fought in two world wars and got to be buried exactly where he wanted, in a field full of heroes. And that's the end of my talk on Hammett.
You said you couldn't do a Liverpool accent. So I'm going to do a segue piece on this day in between the other accents. It's a kind of question and answer session for the panel, essentially. So our question is, King Charles III was crowned earlier this month, but which King of England was crowned on this day in 1199? You can see the answer on the screen.
I know the answer from the research, and it is a figure who's been quite marginalised in modern stories, such as Robin Hood, which is, of course, King John.
Yes, yes, that's the one. Congratulations. And what is probably the most famous event during his reign?
He lost the crown jewels?
No.
No? Okay.
Oh, no, is that a guess or a fact?
That's an absolute fact.
Yeah, well, you got that one then. I was thinking of something else in 1215.
I know the fact that another very famous thing he tried to do was convert the UK to Islam as a way of bargaining with the Ottoman Empire, which is maybe not the most famous fact.
I don't think it's possible. Educated, do you want to put chips on thing?
I was going to say, I feel bad for not bringing something else that you did.
Stick to the script if you want.
No, I can't think of it.
Well, I was thinking of the Magna Carta signing in 1215. It's probably the most famous event. But he was also noteworthy for losing England's lands in France, except for those of Gascony, which led to some chroniclers calling him John Softsword. Bit of an insult there. He married his cousin Isabella, Countess of Gloucester, but abandoned her so he could instead marry another Isabella of Anne Boleyn, who we can deduce was somewhere between 9 and 15 years old. He also got himself excommunicated by the Pope, and prompted this revolt by the barons, which led to the sealing of Magna Carta. Many of the disaffected barons came from the north of England, and that faction were known as the Northerners. The northern barons rarely had any personal stake in the conflict in France, and many of them owed large sums of money to John. And what does Magna Carta actually mean?
There were many,
is
that true? There were many different Magna Cartas.
But what does the phrase Magna Carta mean?
Chocolate covered ice cream?
Oh, that sounds nice in this way. You've got thoughts in my head, mate. Any ideas?
No, but my knowledge of Magna Carta, it begins and ends with the line, did she die in vain? Tony Hancock for those of you.
So it literally means Great Charter. But its full name is, which is maybe what you're looking to, it's Magna Carta Libertatum, or Great Charter of Freedoms. So one of the freedoms was that the barons could not be imprisoned unlawfully. So although scholars refer to the 63 numbered clauses of Magna Carta, this is a modern system of numbering introduced by William Blackstone in 1759. The original charter formed just a single long unbroken text. Four examples of the original 1215 charter remain in existence today. Do we know where any of them are? That's a specialist question.
What? I should, because didn't we do one of these there? Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't remember.
There's one in Canterbury.
No.
Okay, I think I'm
going to do something. I'm going to take a guess at maybe St. Paul's or Westminster Cathedral.
So there are two in London at the British Library. One is at Lincoln Castle, and the other one is at Salisbury Cathedral. Yes. Someone need us in that. Do you want to be on the next panel? Where is Magna Carta signed?
At the bottom!
Yay! Someone has to say that.
Let's get that out of the way.
Where is it signed, though? Place-wise?
Runnymede.
Yeah, thank you. Runnymede, which is near Windsor. Interestingly, the Magna Carta was annulled by the Pope, who was Innocent III, not so innocent as he.
After John's death, the regency government of his young son, Henry III, reissued the document in 1216, with some of its more radical content removed. And at the end of the war in 1270, it formed part of the peace treaty agreed at Lambeth, where the document acquired the name Magna Carta to distinguish it from the smaller Charter of the Forest, which was issued at the same time, so not in their agreement. None of the original 1215 Magna Carta is currently in force, as it was actually repealed. So that's been a kind of subject of contention recently. However, four clauses of the original Charter are enshrined in the reissued Magna Carta of 1297 and still remain in force in England and Wales. So these clauses concern the freedom of the English Church, the ancient liberties of the City of London, and a right to due legal process, which brings me on to the legal term for a right to a trial, which is habeas corpus. Literally translated means you may have the body. So that goes back to medieval times. The expression was used to describe bringing a prisoner into court, and later became used to fight against arbitrary detention by the authorities. The first recorded use of this provision was in 1305, but habeas corpus, as we know today, was not made law until 1679. I'm going to test you on this later. When the Habeas Corpus Act received royal assent, and coincidentally, that happened on this day, 27th of May, in 1679, which is why I'm talking about it. Habeas corpus has actually been suspended a few times since 1679. What events do you think led to its temporary suspension?
War, perhaps? That's usually a favourite.
Yeah, definitely. So we can talk about World War I, World War II, also the French Revolution, when they thought it might be useful then, and one other time in the 20th century. I'm old enough to remember this. There's Northern Ireland, it was introduced in the late 20th century, which actually goes against what's said about England and Wales. Should I say more about this, or should we leave it, given the time? I think we'll move on to Arnold, if that's okay. We'll go to your Wednesday piece, Arnold. Thank you.
Okay, right, so let the foreigner now talk about English history. First of all, I wanted to tell you a little bit about working in a museum. Working in the Museum of London, because like most of the history I know from England is from working there, and a lot of people come into the Museum of London asking where the mummies are. British Museum, and they go, hang on, this is where the dinosaurs are. It's like, where the dinosaurs are. Naturalist Museum, but we've got some amazing bricks. Love to see them. They're all burned and everything. Also, what a lot of people don't realise about the Museum of London, everyone's been to the Museum of London? Yeah, some few million. Okay. Did you know that in the cellar of the Museum of London are 19,000 skeletons? So it's one of the biggest archaeology skeleton archive, which is fantastic. And they've got such a range of things, but it's a really creepy thing to work in, right? So our staff room was right next to this archive of bones. And there was one lady who looks after all of them. She kind of sees them as her babies. And every now and then, this card would come out with like some bones on it. And we called her the bone lady. She was scared of lifts as well, as a little fact. And then so she would shove the bones into the lift, then press the button, run upstairs, and then sort of this lift would open for the visitors. And I'm like, bing! You know, and it was like a skeleton. And I'm like, wait, sorry, that's mine. Take out. But yeah, next time you go there, well, actually you can't because it's closed at the moment, but 19,000 people in the basement. So if you want to know anything about the Great Fire, come and ask me, because I know that. But that did not happen today, unfortunately. So I could not talk about that. So today I wanted to talk to you a bit about Oliver Cromwell. Have we got any fans in Oliver Cromwell? What do you think? Good guy, bad guy? Any strong opinions? It's really hard to pin down, isn't it? Like, I keep changing my mind about him, and I'm not really sure. But I've stared at his face for a very long time. So, I don't know if you know, again, the Museum of London has his death mask, or one of the two, or three, actually, there. So when I worked in the galleries, I used to stare at him. And does anyone know what he's famous for? What were this old punk supposed to have said about his appearance? Anyone not personally remember, of course. And he used to say when a portrait was painted of him, he said,
"Warts and all."
Warts and all, yes. So on his deathbed, no warts. None of them. Which I find very strange. Yeah, exactly. So I was thinking maybe Oliver Cromwell got this very sort of makeover that we're not aware of. Like, sort of, where they painted him really ugly first and then throughout time. Because you're going to Google this later, but the very last coin that was issued in Oliver Cromwell's reign is very, very different from that famous portrait, very sort of Puritan, with like warts and like a slightly stained collar and that sort of real Puritan kind of thing. Do you want to hear a Puritan joke, by the way? Yes. Why did the Puritan punish the cat on a Sunday? Because he caught a mouse, he was working, so. So if you can compare all the Cromwell's reigns, the very first image that you get from him is that very famous portrait of him with like really, as you imagine, a Puritan, like totally not fun. It's a bit how I imagined Theresa May, basically. And then personal opinion there. And then the very last one, he's basically shown as a Roman emperor. Did you notice? Like, with like coral leaves in his hair, like perfect face, and you're like, what happened? What happened there in your 5 years of actual reign that you did? So very interesting, I think, that of course power corrupts, but actually, what happened to this man there? So today, in 1657, I just googled it, thank you very much, he got offered a crown, and he said, because he had sent Parliament home, right? After the war, and he was now the head of the army, so he said, you know what, I actually am quite powerful, I think I can rule England. And they went, oh, do you want to be king? Would you have taken the kingship? What do you think? Would you say yes? Would you say no, right? No, me neither. And of course, Oliver Cromwell said no as well, because he knew what happened to the last one. No, thank you very much. So I will say no. So that happened on this day. And I think he was right. Oliver Cromwell only kind of ruled for a couple of years. And I know one little fact of Oliver Cromwell. Do you know what he died of? Do you mean it? Malaria.
Malaria.
Ironically, if he had been a little bit more tolerant of other religions, he should have been cured, because the Catholics had a cure for this. Yeah, they did. But malaria wasn't actually uncommon in those days in England, because there were more swamps around, so there was more sort of that kind of mosquito and malaria aspect. So he wasn't the first, and he was definitely not the last dying of malaria. And can you go and find Oliver Cromwell's grave? No, you can't. Why not? Does anyone know? What happened after Oliver Cromwell died?
Didn't they dig him up and then throw his body around and
beheaded
him?
Absolutely, yeah. So when Charles II came back, one of the things he did was he punished every single one that had signed the death warrant of his father. And of course, some people had died already. One of them was Oliver Cromwell, so they dug him up. They ceremonially beheaded him, put his head on a spike, and his head then goes missing. It was stolen. And it now lives apparently in Cambridge, I think.
Sydney Sussex.
But of course, we can never prove that it actually is. But they've got someone's head. So that's very
good. If it's looking perfect and regal,
right? So we compare his death mask and sort of put it on top of it. I think he's a very, very interesting character. And I can never kind of, if you ask Irish people, they kind of quite know which side of history is on, isn't it? But I find him quite interesting. How much time have I got? So
two more minutes?
Two more minutes? In my new museum, I've learned something very new as well. That is because today, also in history, in 1849, the Great Hall in Houston opens. Oh, well, that's particularly not very interesting right now. Good. Basically, did you know that there was an age in Victorian time that becomes known as the pneumonic age for Victorians? Does anyone know what pneumonic is? What does that mean, pneumonic? Like a pneumonic tube?
Yeah, it sounds like something from the 1980s. New Manic music.
Like a rock band. Yeah. So pneumatic is like air pressure. So it's the idea that you make a tube that's airtight, and then via air, if something is in front of it, it pushes it forward. So did you know that there was an idea in Victorian times that this was the new technology that was going to take over the world? And so in Chicago, actually, they built a really successful pneumatic system that was underground and with air that pushed things underneath the streets, and so you could send messages. And so it became really interesting for things like the post. Gosh, Anna, what was your new job? Oh, was that on the post museum? But in London, they actually tried it out. So they built a pneumatic tube that went from Holborn to Houston. And there is a sort of a pneumatic case. And they pushed it forward. And it was kind of successful. The only problem was when it broke down. Because when it broke down, someone literally had to crawl in the tube, kind of hook a rope to the carriage, and then literally pull it back. So it was not very, very smooth in that way. And especially with like if the air tightness sort of goes, which in Victorian times with lots of like horse-drawn carriages, and it wasn't dug very deep. So in the end, it was too much effort, and they abandoned it. And they thought it was completely gone, but then in the 1960s they dug it up again. So it still exists. So I'm waiting for somebody to open it and you can go on the pneumatic tube. What do you think? Next heritage attraction. Would you come? Would you go there? Yeah, well, it's a trip down to Houston Hall. So that was my bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think in view of the time, I'm going to skip my next segment and go straight over to you, Mike, first, okay?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. I'm going to talk a bit more about modern history, because today marks the birthday of one of the greatest geniuses and mavericks this country's ever seen. If you think about great British geniuses, from Shakespeare through Jane Austen to Isaac Newton through David Bowie, and this person stands up alongside them, born in very humble beginnings in the northeast of England, the son of a hod carrier and a factory worker. This is somebody who not only displayed their artistry in the northeast of England, but also then conquered the scenes in London and Rome and Glasgow, and going as far as China and Boston, the one in Lincolnshire, of course. Somebody really changed fashion in this country, whether it was through wild hairstyles, through gaudy shell suits, or body prosthetics. So much of a genius and an artist that they were named after two of the Beatles. I'm not talking about Ringo George. I am talking, of course, about Paul John Gascoigne, otherwise known as Gazza. Born on this day in 1967. It's always good to talk about Paul Gascoigne, Geek, because if it goes badly, there's every chance that he will turn up with a fishing rod to bail me out of it. And it's very strange that in one of the biggest, I suppose, heists in this country, or whatever you call it, standoffs, around Mount Incident, that he did turn up almost as the fourth emergency service, and is doing a much better job than, unfortunately, we've been left with in this country, thanks to years and years of cuts. He is a one-off, a lot of people say, but I've been out in Newcastle before on Saturday night, and that is debatable. But he was a real genius, and I feel like there's a lot of parallels in my life and his. I originally lived up north, much like Gazza, and moved down south to try and find fame and fortune as he when he moved to Tottenham Hotspur. Of course, the main impetus for him joining Tottenham Hotspur was that they offered to buy his sister a sunbed if he signed for the club. So I didn't get a sunbed in the mix, as you can probably tell from my pasty complexion, but there's still hope yet. He also came from a mining background in the northeast, a mining town, as I did, albeit a salt mining town. And he had his children down here, as I did. And as Rich mentioned earlier, it's very interesting the way that they talk different. It's very unfamiliar. I've had some concerns with the fact that my children have these little southern accents. I always had these dreams and hopes, because I'm sure Gazza did imagine he'd have these little Geordie children. And what I've had to come to terms with my children sounding like they're from the south is that they'll never do the job that I assumed they would when they grow up, which is reading Women's School poetry over a Halifax advert. So, yeah, very hard to consider. But really, the historical side of Gaza, and he is, unfortunately, in many areas, a figure of fun. He's had tremendous battles with mental health over the years, which he's also been brutally honest about, so not to defend a lot of his actions, but at least he's been transparent with them. He's also managed to conquer a number of areas. Who could forget his number two hit with Lindisfarne, the Pot of the Tide, which obviously changed pop music, but he really did change British culture. If you think back to the 1970s and 80s, football was marginalised in this country. We had a huge problem with hooliganism, a huge problem with racism, and if it wasn't for Italian 90, where Paul Gascoigne just enraptured the entire world, really, with his skill, with his emotion, and the fact that he was a grown working class man on the television willing to cry and show his emotion, where nobody would have ever really done that before. We wouldn't have had the Premier League, we wouldn't have had football on the TV, we wouldn't have the family enclosures and children buying shirts. Not all of it's good, some of it's bad, but he really did change the way that we view the so-called beautiful game in this country. And at the end of the day, if he's remembered for one thing more than any, it's that he was able to become this international celebrity while all the while staying true to his best friend, a man called Jimmy Five Guys. So, yes, I do feel that Paul Gascoigne, his contribution to culture is definitely history worthy and will be spoken about for many more years to come.
So now we come to the second half of the show, where we uncover some of the history of Brighton, and maybe Hove as well. So it seems fitting to start this section on Brighton and Hove by mentioning the football team qualifying for Europe for the first time in its history, as this long season draws to a close. So it's Brighton and Hove Albion. What does the Albion mean? You're the local here, aren't you? So,
why Albion?
Let me just delve into my immense knowledge of football. That's the one on the brown thing, right?
Maybe looking to the wrong person.
I mean, Albion's a fairly common suffix for football clubs. So you have West Bromwich Albion,
yes.
Or in my hometown of Northwich, the Norwich team, Witton Albion. Who probably aren't as well known or successful, but we might get into Europe one day. I think it obviously refers to Britain and England with a history and a connection towards that. I'm not sure where it quite relates to the football team. It would be a lot more straightforward if it was called Brighton and Hove Town.
City.
Only since 2002.
So if you look this up, it's not actually that clear. So Albion is an archaic term for Great Britain, I would say. Apparently it's meant to be associated with areas where there are white cliffs in the south of England, but then that doesn't explain West Bromwich, which is as far removed as you could imagine. One little fact about West Bromwich, it's the highest ground above sea level of all English Premier League and football leagues. Impress your friends with that little fact on it later. So yeah, maybe you can imagine the cliffs 551 feet high if you dug down West Bromwich's ground. What else have we got? So what is Brighton and Hove Albion's nickname and how did they get that?
So their nickname is the Seagulls, but I'm not sure where it comes from.
I'm sorry if I am getting this wrong, if anyone doesn't know the detail, I had to look it up. So they used to be known as the Dolphins. But when there was this rivalry between Crystal Palace and Brighton, which the media always tries to sort of big up, and like 40 miles apart, so they changed their nickname in 1976 so that we had the Seagulls and the Eagles. Mm-hmm. Apparently, this is that. And the Seagull was added to the club's crest in 1977 as a result of that.
See, one would normally think that an eagle is more ferocious than a seagull, but having spent many hours
I have to say, I know Brighton Seagulls, and I imagine that that story is just made up to cover the fact that the seagull hates the dolphin.
Right, so on to the second subject now. What musical event took place in the Brighton Dome on the 6th of April 1974?
Eurovision.
The Eurovision Song Contest. So the UK agreed to host the event after Luxembourg
having won in both 1972 and 1973, declined to host it for a second successive year on the grounds of expense. Nothing's changed there. Mm-hmm. 17 countries took part in the contest that year. Greece took part for the first time. As well as Greece, the UK and Luxembourg have guests as well as participated. What about the Netherlands? Were they there?
Probably.
They were, yes?
Yeah.
I believe Sweden were there that year.
They were, yeah.
Spain?
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of the usual suspects, plus Israel, plus Monaco, and Yugoslavia.
No.
Don't get them anymore for some reason. And who won? Who won that year?
As I alluded to earlier, yes, it's the Swedish act, a little known band called ABBA.
Yes.
Don't know what happened to them.
No, it's hard to imagine. But of course, Sweden won it this year on the 50th anniversary, and some would say that's more than a coincidence. So the group actually broke from convention by being the first winning entry in a language other than that of their home country. Before 1973, all Eurovision singers had been required to sing in their country's native tongue, a restriction that was lifted briefly for the contest between 1973 and 1976. Thus allowing Waterloo to be sung in English. Then that rule was reinstated before ultimately being removed again in 1999. So compared to later ABBA releases, the singer's Swedish accents are decidedly more pronounced on Waterloo. So I've read. I didn't research on this. There's only so much ABBA I can say. At the 50th anniversary celebration of the Eurovision Song Contest in 2005, Waterloo was chosen as the best song competition's history. Now, have a guess. Why did France pull out of Eurovision a few days before the contest that year?
Because they're French.
Why not? Yes. Anything else?
An emergency in France?
Kind of, yes.
Well, I'm going to go and guess that maybe there was some sort of riot or strike.
A nice idea. So actually, the French president, Georges Pompidou, had died on the 2nd of April and was buried 2 days before the contest, which was due on the 4th of April.
Was he supposed to be their entrant?
Yes, that would have been embarrassing. His memorial service was held on the same day as the contest, and the 6th of April was declared the National Day of Mourning. So entertainment and cultural events were cancelled, theatres and schools were closed, and the French broadcaster ORTF made the decision to withdraw the Eurovision entry as a mark of respect, which kind of seems fair. This also meant that the French singer Anne-Marie David, who had won the first place for Luxembourg in 1973, could not come to Brighton to hand the prize to the 1974 winner.
I've got this mental image of some sort of lower government official going up to President Pompidou just before saying, "Mr. President, our song this year is awful. You have to do the honourable thing."
Yeah, I didn't say how he died. Right, another thing you can have a guess at. Why did Italy not broadcast the televised contest on their state television channel, RAI?
Were they just broadcasting some videos of a politician with some scantily clad women just generally hanging around, as seems to be
unfortunately, that's not the answer. No.
Was there something that was better on in Italy?
Something better than the Eurovision Song
Contest?
It's hard to imagine.
A rerun of the Italian Crossroads.
Yes. Any ideas?
No.
So, the contest coincided with the intense political campaign for the 1974 Italian referendum on divorce, which was held a month later in May. So RAI felt that the song, which was entitled "Si," and repeatedly featured the word "si," or "yes," could risk the accusation of being a subliminal message and a form of propaganda to influence the Italian voting public to vote "yes" in the referendum. The song was not played on most Italian state TV and radio stations until the referendum had been held. So the Italian entry was actually the runner-up behind Sweden at the end. You probably want to know how the referendum went. So what the Italians were voting on was whether they wanted to repeal a government law passed 3 years earlier which allowed divorce for the first time in modern Italian history. Those voting yes wanted to outlaw divorce, as had been the case before the law came into effect, and those voting no wanted to retain the law when they newly gained right to divorce. Did they vote C or not?
It's a
double
thing. I'll go not. I'll go C.
What's your vote?
I go C as
well. Well, 13.1 million voted C and 19.1 million voted no. I'm not as impressed with you.
Well, I'll just be right over here. It's the one thing I've known so far.
So divorce was kept as a result of that referendum.
I'm also quite amused by the Italians wanting to pull back the song that kind of, you know, went on the subject of divorce in a year that Abel won. With fairly big public divorces, wasn't it?
Yeah, both married and both divorces. Yeah. Couples and then reformed as virtual reality characters, which kind of sounds like an ideal marriage to me.
Right, so move on to something else about Brighton. What 7 mile long construction did Sir John Hawkshaw design for Brighton in 1874?
Was it West Street on a Saturday night? Feels like it.
That's not the answer I got.
The award
winning
beach?
No. Do you think he designed the beach?
Well, is that right? It seems very well designed.
No, unless it's the world's worst designed beach calculator, I'm not sure.
So it was a brick lined sewer. Visitors have been flocking to Brighton ever since Dr. Richard Russell publicly suggested in 1750 that the waters of Brighton could cure all manner of ailments, making Brighton the fastest growing town in the whole country, something we covered in the show last year. The downside of this, however, was the provision for sewage or mains water couldn't keep up with the building works. So ironically, there were terrible health implications for Brighton residents. With a major cholera outbreak in Brighton's slums in the mid-19th century, leading to campaigns by the Lancet to deal with the problem. An 1849 report found that only 32 out of 186 streets were fitted with any sewers, but there were several thousand cesspits cut into the chalk, many of them near drinking water wells, and which never needed emptying. And stable manure oozed through adjacent house walls, and during heavy rainfall, raw sewage would flood into people's basements through the porous chalk.
And this is why, if you look at modern people in Brighton, even today, none of them are drinking water.
Interestingly, the place where I stayed turned up this afternoon, she said the water's drinkable, and I thought, well, why would it not be? And that was the thing I realised now. It's not in the basement there, so maybe I'll say. So the lanes apparently had sewage trickling down the streets into the storm drains and down to the sea where it would be washed back onto the beach. So Hawkshaw's sewer dealt with the problem of transporting sewage as far as the sea, where it was pumped right up until the 1990s, when a giant storm water collection drain was constructed along the beach. So have a guess, panel. How much wastewater do you think the Victorian sewers help dispose of nowadays from the Brighton and Hove area? In gallons.
What's the time frame?
Every day.
Every day? Oh.
On average.
10 million gallons.
Wow. Not a bad guess. Not a bad guess.
I think it's more.
Going higher.
Like
18. Any plans on 18?
No, I'll wait to answer it.
Okay, it's 22. So, yeah, very, very close. 22 million gallons of wastewater every day. But in wet and stormy weather, this can be as much as 90. Mm-hmm. Now, apparently, you can go on a tour of Brighton sewer systems. Is that not done? I don't know if it's recommended. In the summer months, and through 366 metres of sewage tunnel, which sounds like a lot to me, starting at the Brighton Palace Pier and ending by popping Aspen Manhole. So, yeah, give it a try. Unless you think it sounds crap.
Is it the addition there of in the summer months? I understand there will be practical reasons for there being too much water in winter. But is that, do you know what? It's a hot today. Where should we go?
But when was the Brighton sewer?
So it was 1874 that it was designed. Oh, okay. So actually, fairly recent in that sense.
Because in 1852 you get the Great Stink, the Great Stink of London. The Great Stink, which was in the end, because you had Jon Snow, right? Does everybody know about Jon Snow?
And which Jon Snow?
So yes, exactly, which one? The one that figured out the pump thing. So he figured it out like 10 years, the stink. That water was the one that gave people cholera. And then he tried to tell everyone, he's like, look, the water is making people sick, we need to do something about it. They didn't listen. Then you get the Great Stink, because the summer in London that was so hot that all the rubbish in London's camps started to rot. And where is Parliament? Exactly. It's on the Thames, isn't it? So it was actually, the rumour goes that it was Parliament that couldn't open the windows anymore because of the smell that was so great that they finally started to listen and started to change the sewer system.
It's equivalent to rising to your own penny.
Yes.
More direct way.
There's a particularly gruesome story with the Jon Snow discovery because he found it was a particular water valley in Soho, where there's now a pub called Jon Snow, actually, also, which serves beer that tastes vaguely similar to it. But when he did his research and mapped where people were getting cholera, there was one outlier, and it turned out it was somebody's mother who requested their child take water from that well because she particularly liked that it tasted a bit sweeter, which really just means she particularly enjoyed drinking sewage. So, yeah. There's a nice thing. Bring me the spoons later.
But there was one other thing of how he figured it out, which is that you're absolutely right. There was a group of people that didn't get sick, and that was the people that worked in the beer factory that was close up to that pump. Mm-hmm. And why did they not got sick? Because they got paid in beer. Mm-hmm. So they drank beer instead of water.
Yeah. So if you needed an excuse to drink beer, what greater reason?
That's a big part of London history, don't they? Because it used to be the small beer they called it. People would regularly drink small beer as opposed to water, which was a very, very low alcoholic beer that people would just drink as their regular drink.
That's one of the first small beers.
Possibly.
Interesting. Okay. Right. Sorry for bringing the topic down. I thought it'd be nice to come sort of put in context all that we said about last year, like how nice the mineral water was that people were coming to for, but actually it's in the context of something rather grosser. But anyway, let's move on and talk about St. Bartholomew's Church, which I saw on the way to the event here this afternoon. It's in the North Lane, and is supposedly built to the same dimensions as what structure in the Bible?
The Ark, isn't it?
The Ark.
Oh. There's a couple of arcs in there, aren't there? No.
Is there more than one?
There's the covenant.
Oh, the Ark of the Covenant. Oh, I see, sorry, yes. I was thinking, there's more than one. I don't remember that bit. He's already given the right answer. So, yeah, Noah's Ark in the book of Genesis. So, I'll explain how that myth has arisen in a minute. The church was built by the Reverend Arthur Douglas Wagner, an extremely wealthy Anglo-Catholic and curator of St. Paul's Church in Westbury. What is remarkable about the building's height? If you see it, you...
Supposedly, is it the tallest parish church in, is it Britain or in Europe?
Yes, it all depends how you define it. So yes, it's something like the tallest brick-built church in England, or even in Europe, as parish churches go, the nave is the largest in Britain. But it's all about definitions. But it's 170 feet long, it's 59 feet wide, and 135 feet to the ridge of the roof. So I could do that in meters, but you've been here. And it's got a 9-foot cross on the roof at the south end. I'll spare you some of the detail. How much do you think it cost to build? So we're talking about 1874 prices to build a church.
They have coupons.
I don't know.
18
If we're
talking
about
£20,000. Wow, that is remarkably close to the right answer. I'm not sure you can improve on that, can you? No, I've said that, maybe.
Since you said incredibly close, it's a bit of a slimy try.
So I'll tell you. Yeah, so £18,000.
and in today's prices that would be 2.6 million. The church had entirely free seating throughout for up to 1,500 worshippers. It became the first church in Brighton to offer universal free entrance from the date of opening. Who was this unpopular with and why?
Seagulls?
What, the football team?
Football team, all that. Birds of prey.
The Archbishop?
Yeah, so local members of the clergy didn't like it because they historically gained reliable incomes from the practice of pew rents in the style of Ireland. At a town council meeting in 1893, it was reported that the overall height of the building was 2 feet higher than the approved plans of 1873, which led to much criticism. Question again for you to guess. At the time, how much was the statutory fine for that planning violation?
I'm going to say £20,000.
That was right last time. I'm thinking of something like that.
£5?
£5? Somewhere in the middle.
Did they say euros as well?
I think it's been invented. The fine was 40 shillings or £2. So they just didn't bother imposing it because it wasn't worth it. Wagner was quite rich, so it was a white bubble. The meeting minutes recalled that a variety of derogatory descriptions of the building were made. What do you make, panel, of these descriptions? So, marks out of 10. For biting sarcasm, someone called it a huge barn.
Four.
Okay, what about uselessly large, painfully ugly, and sadly out of place?
Is that the next one?
It's like a star for effort, like giving it a lot of words.
Yeah. Someone else said it was like a cheese warehouse.
That sounds great.
Not quite like that. Don't know what they mean by that. And another one was a monstrous excrescence.
Which surely has just been flushed down the room.
Yes, it does sound like it. Another one was a brick parallelogram.
I'm pretty sure they had a top 10 hit in 1987 with their love groove thing. Yeah.
They were back to the pneumatics,
wasn't it? Yeah. I just feel that there's somebody there who's for their whole life has known the word parallelogram and never had a chance to use it. So, this is my moment!
Yeah. Someone else called it Wagner's Folly, or Wagner's Folly, and someone else called it a Noah's Ark in brick. And that's where the Noah's Ark comes from, because it's given rise to the myth that the building's dimensions are the same as Noah's Ark. Now, residents of the houses immediately to the west of the church complained to Wagner that the height of the church caused downward drafts of wind, which caused their chimneys to smoke excessively. So what did Wagner do about that to counter their objections?
Did he get rid of all that houses and turn them into the Ladbrokes and Starbucks that house around the church?
That probably came later.
Did you go on Twitter?
Got
really angry?
Yeah, that was a lot when you do that.
There's some nice green space around there. Did he sort of make some green spaces?
So he was a rich man, so he basically was able to buy some of the houses and reduce the tenant's rents and that kind of get the climate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you have money, there's always a way around it. So
the lot of rents and the emphasis you look at.
1826. Very, very quickly, I'll mention Doreen. I'm not sure if I'm saying this right. Doreen Valiente. Does anyone know about Doreen Valiente? She was the mother of modern witchcraft. Mm. Born in 1922, and she lived in Brighton, which is why I'm covering her here. So she's credited with changing the wider understanding of witchcraft in the 20th century as being more a religion of love and understanding. So, just a Q&A, quick thing. Of the following statements about her, which are true and which are false? So, number one, she worked in a branch of Boots the Chemist.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, I think
she did. She did, yeah, in 1970. Number two, she worked at Bletchley Park during the Second World War.
She's probably not the most famous person to work there, but yeah.
Okay, I'll buy that.
They wouldn't hire witches.
She worked at Leicester Guards in the Second World War. She was a Foreign Office civilian temporary senior assistant officer, which is a bit
insane. I had someone talk about Leicester recently, and they said basically the application process was, can you do a crossword? Fantastic, turn up here on Monday.
Well, she was working as a translator, so I guess that was certainly enough for she's good at crosswords. Another question, she was a member for the far-right white nationalist political party, the National Front.
I'm going to be honest, she sounds a lot less endearing all of a sudden. I'm hoping that's false.
Yeah, me too.
I'm hoping it's false, but worrying it's not.
It's true. She was a member for about 18 months and designed a banner for her local branch. She was also a member of the neo-Nazi Northern League, and they weren't very pleasant people.
Well, I'm going to start going to Super Drug now.
Yes. One more. She was an avid football fan.
That's good.
I'm going to assume true again because of the far right nationalism back in the day.
Yeah, sure.
She was. She closely followed the World Cup, refusing to open the door to any visitors while she was watching on TV. And she also enjoyed betting on horse races. So, there you go. Different view of what witches are like now.
I'd rather use the classic true false pattern of true, true, true. true.
Just a few. So, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. So, I just would like to thank the Brighton Fringe and the Brighton Spider Modern Museum for hosting us today, and to thank all the guests who participated in the show, Richie Rounds, Arna Speck, and Mike Coxon. Our next show will be at the Wandsworth Arts Fringe Festival on Thursday, 22nd of June at 1900 at the Bedford in Ballon. And now a final on this day piece with which to end the show. Comedian Eric Morecambe died overnight on 28th of May 1984 after suffering a heart attack immediately after taking 6 curtain calls. Imagine that? Following a performance at the Roses Theatre in Tewkesbury. Here are some quotes from him with which to end the show. So the first one. I get to Essex just licking an airmail stamp. Number two, I used to play football in my youth. Then my eyes went bad. That's why I became a referee. Number three, I always take my wife morning tea in my pyjamas. But is she grateful? No, she said she'd rather have it in a cup. And probably the most famous phrase from Eric was, I'm playing all the right notes, just not necessarily in the right order. No. And on that note, goodbye.